is. Perennial quota is now in session. Please be seated.
Dr. Dwyer.
Ron, sorry.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Edwardson.
I apologise. Ron, it was an app that I overlooked yesterday. I'd like to formally tender my name to exhibits.
Sure.
It's item number 7155C and 7155D. Sorry, let's start again. 7115D. D is the original noble of Constable Rolfe, and C are the transcribed copy of the document, which was done by SAPOL, which formed part of the prosecution. It's part of the prosecution brief.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Edwardson. They'll be given exhibit numbers very shortly, I'm sure.
Your Honour, the first and only witness today is Ms. Claudia Campagnaro. Ms. Campagnaro has a non-publication order over her image. And so because of the technical challenges in this court, we're not able to both live stream and see her in a way that protects her image. But what we will be doing is recording these proceedings today so that the recording is available on our website and can be listened to by anybody who is interested in her evidence. And, of course, as Your Honour knows, we are doing a summary at the end of each week to have translated in Walpuri, and that will be done so that the community will have an understanding of what Ms. Campagnaro has said, and anybody who wants to listen to it more closely can do so at a later date.
And the transcript will also be on the website.
Exactly.
May I ask for more basis, if I may? The non-publication order has been made. The parties of the case have not been asked about it. Ms. Campagnaro's image is freely available on the internet in the presence of my client, Zachary Rolfe, and the whole variety of people place.
Dr. Dwyer?
Yes, Your Honour. Well, a request was made by Ms. Campagnaro for a non-publication order over her image because she has come forward and given some evidence that, in effect, on previous occasions, made her the subject of targeted insult. There's a social media campaign, as Your Honour is aware, campaign perhaps is one way to describe it. I'll just describe it in a more neutral term and withdraw that. It's the website I Back Zach, which is a support campaign for Constable Rolfe, has from time to time contained material which is abusive towards other people, including, for example, Sergeant Frost. And on occasion, there has been social media that is abusive directed towards Ms. Campagnaro. And she, in my respectful submission, has understandable concerns as to the way in which she might be treated on social media, including on that website, on that site.
I understand. That's the position the court takes, and it's appropriate that they're in order in those terms. It's not the evidence that she's about to do so.
And can I say that it is obviously the court is open, and anyone present is able to view the proceedings in their entirety. And had we had the technology available, we would have continued to broadcast audio only today, but we can't do that. So we did try to maintain the open court as much as possible, and in fact we are continuing to proceed in open court today.
Thank you.
It's just a non-publication of the image of Ms. Campagnaro.
Thank you, Your Honour. And just to be clear, there is a proper basis for this in circumstances where there are attacks on witnesses in social media. On that website, there are criticisms of various people, including myself as counsel assisting, in extremely derogatory terms. I am personally able to withstand that because I'm an officer of the court and I don't take it personally. But in circumstances where witnesses, like Sergeant Frost and like Ms. Campagnaro, want to come to this court and have to give evidence that in some circumstances might be challenging and difficult for them, then it is entirely proper that they be afforded the protection so that they're not intimidated to give evidence.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honour. I call Ms. Campanella.
Yes. So at this stage, we're going to break the live stream. Have we already done that? Not yet. And we're going to return to the live stream at 9:30 on Monday morning. Mr. Mullen?
Yeah, just while that's happening, Your Honour, can I just indicate that the families have limited questions for Ms. Campagnaro, and myself and Mr. Hearn will be leaving later in the morning.
Thank you.
Ms. Campagnaro, thank you for making yourself available to give evidence today. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Before you give any evidence, do you promise to tell the truth to the court? Thank you.
Ms. Campagnaro, can you see and hear me okay?
Yes.
Could you please state your full name for the court?
Claudia Maud Griffiths Campagnaro.
And Ms. Campagnaro, if you drop out at any time, I'll remind you, but you're a tiny bit soft. So I'm sorry to have to ask you. That's terrific. Thank you for that.
I've been sick.
Sit so you feel comfortable, but we can now see and hear you. Is that okay,
sure,
Your Honour?
I think that's fine. You just need to keep your voice up. I'm sorry that you've been ill. If you become a little quiet, we'll just remind you, okay? And if you need a break or anything, just let us know. We will have a morning break, a lunch break as well.
Okay.
Ms. Campagnaro, you're coming. I'm not going to ask you what your address is, but you're physically located outside of the Northern Territory. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
You work now as a nurse?
Yes, I do.
You were interviewed by police on the 19th of August 2020, and the transcript is some 92 pages and appears in Her Honour's brief of evidence. Do you have a copy of the transcript with you today? Okay. We're losing you a bit, so I'll keep asking some questions, make sure we can hear you. You were asked by police in the Northern Territory to participate in that interview because of a previous relationship that you had had with Constable Zachary Rolfe. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I'll come to some more details about this, but just to put it in context, you were in a romantic relationship with Constable Rolfe from around January, February 2018 through to the end of 2018. Is that right?
That's correct.
And for a period of time in that year, you were engaged to him?
Yes, I was.
When was the last time that you saw him?
September or October 2018.
Right.
I can't be 100%.
So you haven't maintained contact after that time?
Nothing.
On the 9th of November 2019, you were not living in the Northern Territory, is that right?
No, I wasn't.
Do you remember now how you first heard that there had been a shooting death in Yuendumu?
I think maybe I had been told by a fellow officer that I used to speak to, or I'd seen it on the news. I can't be up.
It was some time then before you were interviewed, and by the time you were being interviewed in August 2020, Zach Rolfe had been charged with murder and manslaughter. Were you keen to give an interview to Northern Territory Police about him?
No, I wasn't. I didn't know that I was being interviewed until 48 hours.
Until, did you say 48 hours before?
I think it was about 48 to 24 hours before.
And how did that interview come about?
I had a phone call from the Northern Territory Police detective to tell me that I was going to be giving an interview in Adelaide.
In Adelaide, is that right?
Yeah, and they were flying down.
Okay. Now, at the time, had you ever been interviewed by police in relation to any incident?
No, I had not.
When you sat down with the interviewers to talk to them, how were you feeling?
Incredibly intimidated.
Did you feel like it was something that you wanted to actively do, give evidence about someone you'd previously been in a relationship with?
Absolutely not.
We're losing you a bit, Claudia, when you go back and forth. So I'll just repeat that because I can hear you okay. But you said absolutely not. It was very, very stressful.
Yes.
Did you, when you were participating in that interview, understand that you were under an obligation to give a truthful account of what you knew?
Yes. At the beginning of the interview, I had to state that I was going to tell the truth.
And did you tell the truth in your interview?
Yes, I did.
You are now, as I understand it, in a new relationship, is that right?
Yes, a very happy life.
And you're keen to move on with your life, as I understand?
Very, very keen to move on with my life.
Has it been challenging for you to have had your name in the media, for example?
Incredibly invasive. My name, my phone number, media, it's been very, very stressful.
Are you nevertheless, Ms. Campagnaro, prepared to come to court and tell the truth today about what you know about these circumstances?
Yes, I am.
Ms. Campagnaro, I'm going to ask you a little bit first about your background. You were born in 1994. You're now 28 years of age. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
And when did you first come to the Northern Territory?
Well, I came a little bit before I started my training with police, so early. Yeah.
Okay. We're just losing you. You're cutting out a little bit, Ms. Campagnaro. I'm wondering, is your volume right up as far as it can be?
Yeah, it's full. It's full.
That's great. Okay. We can hear you when you just said that. So I think you said you came to the Northern Territory just a little bit before you started your training as a police officer.
Yeah.
And what year was it?
2017.
Okay. And what brought you to the Northern Territory?
It's just something different to do.
Did you... come up specifically for the job to be a police officer up here?
Yes, yes I did.
And how old were you when you first arrived in the Territory?
24.
Had you had any sort of career prior to coming to the Territory?
Not really, no.
What had prior to coming to the Territory, had you worked, I would draw that, had you had much contact with Aboriginal people?
Not really, no. Not in that place.
When you first joined the police force in the Northern Territory, were you enthusiastic about the job?
Yes, very.
Were you excited to join the police force?
Yeah, I was. I had always wanted to be an officer.
And when you did your squad, I think, I would draw that, you did your training in, as a 24-year-old police officer in Darwin, is that right?
That's right.
And did you enjoy your training?
Yes, it was challenging, but it was rewarding at the same time.
Do you remember, we're asking all the witnesses who've come to court to give evidence about this, do you remember now having any training on cross-cultural issues or cultural competency?
A little bit, I think. I mean, I can't remember specifically, but there was a little bit about it.
Okay. Do you remember going into a community or anything like that?
Not in Darwin.
Was it anything, the cross-cultural training or cultural competency, was it anything that you remember, was there anything significant that you remember about it that was meaningful to you?
Well, not really. Just that the majority of clientele, there would be a large majority of Indigenous people. They were trying to give us a bit more of a background.
All right. We're just having to, are you able, I'll just check with Joanna. Joanna, are you able to hear Claudia?
We are losing words here and there. We'll keep trying. If it is causing a problem for anyone, the alternative is to cut the audio on the computer and have a visual from the computer and a phone connection as well. We'll keep trying though and we'll see how we go.
Okay, sorry.
No, don't apologise. It's technology and we're going to do our best, and if we need to come up with a workaround, we will.
Okay.
Ms. Campagnaro, where was your first posting as a police officer?
It was in Alice Springs.
And that was sometime in 2017, is that right?
December.
Okay. So am I right that from December 2017 until the following October or November 2018, you were a young police officer in Alice Springs?
Yes, I was.
Were you a probationary constable for the whole time?
Yes, I was.
And when you left Alice Springs, you were in general duties for the whole time you were there, is that right?
Yes, Alice Springs, general duty.
And when you left Alice Springs in October or November 2018, did you work anywhere else as a police officer?
No, I did not.
Did you effectively leave the police force after that
yes.
year?
What? I never joined any other officer.
Why did you leave the police force?
Police, it just didn't give me job satisfaction. I realised it wasn't what I wanted to do, and my passion was actually to be.
That your passion was actually to be, sorry, we lost you at the end.
A nurse.
Okay. And that you've been able to pursue that passion since that time?
Yes, I studied and now I'm a registered nurse.
Okay, terrific. So I'm going to come now to ask you some questions about meeting Zach Rolfe. You met him, of course, when you were a police officer in Alice Springs and he was working as an officer. You explain in your interview that he was a couple of squads before you. So maybe 12 months or so he'd already been in Alice Springs working as an officer, correct?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
And you were a probationary constable when he was a constable, is that right?
That's correct.
Before you met Zach, when you arrived at the station, do you recall finding out about his reputation?
No, not that I can recall.
Did you meet him soon after you arrived in Alice Springs?
Yes, I believe I met him in December.
You explain in your statement at page 6, or your interview, you said, Zach, shortly after, one time, like we were on a changeover shift, and he came and introduced himself to me and shook my hand, and that was my first knowing of him. Then, not long after that, I found out later that he had organised on purpose to go on a job with me, looking for someone, and that's how he started talking to me. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. He then got your number, and he texted you to say thanks for the job.
Yes.
And then he heard through a friend that you were having some issues with your dog crying at night, so he offered to look after your dog for a while when you were on shifts.
Yes.
Which is a appeared to you to be a kind and nice thing to do.
Cool, of course, yes.
And it was obvious to you at that time that he might be keen to go on a date.
Yes.
Well, did that all happen prior to you interviewing Malcolm Ryder?
I actually can't recall.
Okay.
I met him in December and Malcolm Ryder was January, so there's not much time.
True. So I'll come to Mr. Ryder then. On the 11th of January 2018, Malcolm Ryder was arrested by a number of police officers, Constable Lorraine Constable Geranius, Constable Rolf, and Constable Zendelli. Did you know, bearing in mind you hadn't recently been in Alice Springs, did you know any of those people before that time?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Who did you know from those four?
I knew all of them.
Okay. So you'd been introduced to all of them beforehand?
Yes, yeah, because when you start your shift, you get to meet other officers.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Have we started the shift, you get to meet other officers.
Thank you.
And out of those four that I just mentioned, did you have any particular friendship with any of them?
Not at that point, no.
You'd only really just met them, is that right? Mr. Ryder was interviewed by yourself and another officer who you referred to as Fish?
Fisher, yes.
Fisher, okay. I think that his full name is Jason Gerbitz Fisher. Does that ring a bell to you? That him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you recall what rank he was at the time of that interview?
Maybe a first class constable.
He was certainly above you in rank because you were a probationary constable, is that right?
Yeah, he was a lot more senior.
So this is what you say at page 8 of your interview, Ms. Campagnaro. You say, there was this one job where I had to interview someone that had been placed under arrest, Malcolm Ryder, and I had to interview him. And I remember not liking Zach because Malcolm Ryder had this massive gash above his head. My partner that him and I both interviewed, he wasn't happy about it either. So that was another interaction. So I didn't actually like him in the beginning. I thought he just loved himself, and I hated that Malcolm Ryder thing, and I still remember. That's how I remember his name.
That is correct.
That's a truthful account of what happened with the interview?
Yes, it is.
Malcolm Ryder, we know, had an injury above his right eye after following an arrest from that group of four I just read the names of. He required 10 stitches above his right eye and 3 stitches above his left eye. There was an attempt by yourself and Officer Fisher to interview him, is that right?
Thanks.
And you started the interview and then stopped it after a time, is that right?
That is correct.
During the time that you started the interview, had Mr. Ryder already been to the hospital to receive some treatment for his head wounds?
Yes, because before you can be interviewed, you have to have your wounds tended to. That's...
And when Mr. Ryder was speaking with you and Officer Fisher, did he complain about the arrest?
Yes, he did, over and over again.
What sort of things did he say?
First of all, he said that the officer had the devil in his eyes.
He said the officer had the devil in his eyes? Yes. Lean forward, please, Ms. Campagnaro.
He just kept saying over and over again that he hadn't done anything.
That he kept saying over and over again that he hadn't done anything wrong, Mr. Ryder?
Yeah.
He told you that the officer had the devil in his eyes. Did he tell you which officer?
No, he just said that officer.
Okay. Did he say anything else about how he had suffered those injuries?
To be honest, his English was incredibly poor, so that's why we ceased the interview. He did not understand the preamble. He really didn't understand the
interview.
He didn't understand the preamble, and he didn't understand the interview at all. Do you think that it would be, could we at least give it a go on the phone, and then Ms. Campagnaro might feel more comfortable too because she can sit back from the screen and then we'll hear your voice on the phone?
I mean, I could do it on my phone with my headphones. It just means I have to hold it. So I'm happy to do.
Your Honour, when Ms. Campagnaro, she speaks very close to the microphone. It seems to come through very clearly. I think it's when she moves back.
I don't know, is it possible for you to stay that close or is that difficult?
I mean, I can, but it's obviously very uncomfortable.
Right. I might just take a short adjournment. We'll try getting you on the phone and turning off the audio on your computer or putting that on mute. And we'll see if we've got if we can hear you a bit better through the phone. I'll just adjourn briefly while we sort that out. Ms. Campagnaro, I'm hoping that we'll be able to hear you clearly now as we did during the break. Can you hear us?
Okay. I can.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay. So I was asking you previously about the interview you did with Mr. Ryder, and you had Officer Jason Gerbitz Fisher there with you. And you, when I asked you what Mr. Ryder said about how he got the injury, you said that he kept saying over and over again that he hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And he said that officer had the devil in his eyes.
Yes, that is correct.
And you gave evidence that when you were interviewed, you said, and I remember not liking Zach because Malcolm Ryder had this massive gash above his head, and my partner that him and I both interviewed, he wasn't happy about it either. You were there with somebody much more senior to you. You'd only been in the job a month or so.
A month.
What did your more senior officer say about it?
Fisher said to me that they'd done a bit of a dodgy.
Excuse me, I appreciate the rules of evidence that apply in this jurisdiction, but unless that officer's been called, it's not appropriate to simply produce an opinion that's being expressed by another officer that's not available for cross-examination. By all means, this witness can tell us what she saw, what she heard, and any conversation that she had directly with Zachary Locke on the relevant topic.
I'm happy to make the officer available for cross-examination, so I do press the question in terms of, and I'll ask it directly in terms of what this witness heard the other officer say.
But
the other officer is now going to be made available.
Yes, that officer can give evidence about what he observed and why he might have expressed that opinion. It's not to the point that he might have said something in the presence of this witness.
First of all, the rules of evidence don't apply, as my learned friend says. But in circumstances where that officer was not available at all, I would take my learned friend's point about the difficulty of challenging it or testing it. But it goes right to the heart of any concerns and whether they're credible or not. It's relevant to this witness's credibility and so to that witness's credibility.
Well, I don't even have a statement from this other officer. I don't know what this other officer says about it, so how can I cross-examine her on this topic if you don't have a statement that informs me relevantly about what he says actually happened on this particular occasion we're now talking about?
I'll deal with it in this way. I'll ask this witness whether or not the other officer said anything to her about his concerns, and then I'm going to get a statement from the officer.
Thank you.
If I then have to get another statement from Ms. Campagnaro, I will do. Ms. Campagnaro, did the other officer, Officer Fisher, say anything to you about his concerns?
Okay, so
I can't tell you exactly what was said.
Okay. But did and
but he so he was unhappy.
Ms. Campagnaro, sorry to do this to you, and I'm sorry that we're interrupting. You're just being asked whether the police officer said anything to you, not what he said. So it's just a very specific question. Did he say anything to you about his concerns? So that's really a yes or no, or I can't remember.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right, and then I'll follow that up, Your Honour. Don't feel bad about the fact that you've just been interrupted then. It's just evidentiary issues, Ms. Campagnaro.
Fine.
Ms. Campagnaro, had you ever interviewed anybody prior to this interview with Mr. Ryder?
No, I had not.
So at that time, was it important to you to, as a learning exercise, to be sitting there with a more senior officer?
Yes, it was.
You were watching the way that he ran those proceedings or ran that interview?
Yeah. Yes, I was.
Did you at that stage have an interpreter available to you?
No, there was not.
Do you recall there being any consideration of calling the Aboriginal Interpreter Service and bringing someone in?
I actually can't remember.
Do you remember now whether or not when you're going through your training, you were trained in the use of Aboriginal interpreters?
Yes, we were.
In those circumstances, in terms of getting an interpreter for Mr. Ryder, I take it that would have, you would have been looking for guidance from your senior officer as to when that was appropriate.
Yes, I was.
Did you have any discussions with your senior officer at that time about, and I'll ask you this as a yes or no to begin with as well, did you have any discussions with Officer Fisher about whether or not you should escalate your concerns, that is, make a complaint on behalf of the interviewee?
No.
At the time that you interviewed Mr. Ryder, did you, or beforehand, did you review any body-worn video footage from the incident?
I can't recall if it was before or after.
At some stage, you did look at that body-worn video, is that right?
Yes, I did.
And I think, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, it was only one of the officers, Officer Brett Geranios, who turned on his body-worn video. How did you come to look at it?
Someone would have shown me.
Did you look at it as part of your investigation into what had happened with Mr. Ryder, or just simply outside of that?
Outside of that.
Did Zach show it to you at all?
I cannot recall.
Just want to take you to some conversations you had with Zach Rolfe about that incident.
Yep.
When do you recall was the first time that you spoke to Zach about what had happened?
January the 11th, the day that it actually happened.
Okay. How did that conversation come about?
So we were on opposite shifts. And when I started my shift, he spoke to me at the front office about what had happened because he'd just come back from the job.
So did he speak to you about what happened before you even interviewed Mr. Ryder or attempted to?
Yes, he did.
And what did Zach say to you about what had happened?
He just told me that everyone had been sprayed with OC spray and that Ryder had a gash on his head.
Did he tell you, first of all, how everyone had been sprayed?
Yes, he did.
And how did that happen?
One of the officers had party-packed everyone with OC spray, and that was Brett.
Okay. And is that an expression, is that a sort of slang expression, party-pack, or is that a formal police term?
Sorry, that's a slang expression for the larger OC spray bottle.
And If you use that larger OC spray bottle in a confined space, is it the case that a lot of people in the area, or people in the area, will get sprayed?
Yes, that is correct.
When Zach was telling you about that, was he joking about the spraying?
Well, he was covered in spray.
Okay.
So and he was sorry, wetty.
He was messy. Okay. And did he tell you anything about how Mr. Ryder had got that gash?
Not at that time, no.
So So was there only one conversation with him prior to that interview?
Yes.
And then when was the next time that you spoke to Zach about Mr. Ryder?
I'd say some point after we'd started dating.
Okay. So can I just be clear that on the 11th of January, you spoke to Zach before you interviewed or tried to interview Mr. Ryder. Was there any other conversation with Zach on that day about it?
Not that I can recall, no.
So then what you explain in your statement is that, or your interview is that at page 8, Zach was helping you with your dogs, and then obviously the friendship turned into more than a friendship and you started a relationship. And you say, and then seriously, not long after that, he proposed to me, like within 4 or 5 weeks of knowing him.
That is correct.
And from that time on, you were engaged to him, I think from about March through to the end of the year, correct?
That's correct.
Do you remember roughly how long into your relationship he told you something else about the Ryder incident?
I cannot give you specifics. It was just after we had started dating.
Okay. So at page 10 of your statement, you're asked a question by the interviewers. Tell me in as much detail about the particular conversation you had with Zach. And you say, I'm just trying to recollect, it's 2 years ago. I was working, I can't remember his name, he's out somewhere now. We were on a changeover, so we were doing evening and they were doing morning, and we had obviously to interview this guy that they'd just arrested, and they were covered in spray. So Zach, they'd all been sprayed and the members had been sprayed. His ex-girlfriend was on that patrol group. She was involved in that job. Can you remember who that ex-girlfriend was?
Her last name's Zendeli. She goes by Jen.
Did you know at that time that Zach had been in a relationship with Miss Zendeli?
I think it had been mentioned to me before.
You go on to say someone called Maxie, he was involved in that job. That was...
Lorraine.
Constable Max Lorraine.
Yes, that's him.
A detective in the Northern Territory was involved in that job, who I really like. That was
Brett.
That was Brett. Okay. And you go on to say that he's a straight shooter. By that, do I take it that you mean he's someone who's, you know, to be generally honest?
Yes, very by the book.
You say, so there was a domestic violence job. I'm just trying to remember. They'd gone in and apparently the defendant, Malcolm Ryder, shone his phone at them. And that was kind of their justification for spraying him. And when he was on the ground, I think him and his ex were punching and kicking Malcolm Ryder. And then Zach told me later, so this was after, so that's the job I know of. And then later when I was at the station, Zach told someone else, and I can't remember who else was with me, like secretly when the cameras weren't looking at work, that he had someone scratch him. I can't remember where it was though. Someone upstairs had scratched for him, so he could say in his use of force that was why he'd given him, Mr. Ryder, that gash on the forehead. So on the day of the 11th of January, Mr. Ryder told you that he hadn't done anything wrong when he got those injuries. Sometime later, you had a conversation with Zach. What did Zach tell you?
He told me that a detective upstairs had scratched him so that in his use of force documentation, he could say that's why he had used force on Mr. Ryder.
Did he tell you who the detective was upstairs who'd done that?
No, he did not.
By upstairs, you were in Alice Springs at that time. Did you take him to be referring to a detective in Alice Springs?
Yeah, so upstairs is because the detectives were based upstairs in the Alice Springs police station.
Can you recall now what prompted this discussion with Zach about what had happened?
Well, there was a PSC investigation, so that's why we were talking about it.
Okay. PSC is Professional Standards Command, is that right?
That's correct.
In terms of, that's why we were talking about, did Zach say anything to you that gave him the impression that he was worried about that investigation?
He did seem worried because it was being taken to court.
And by it was being taken to court, do you mean the Malcolm Ryder matter was being taken to court?
Yes, it was.
Mr. Ryder was being charged with offences that resulted from it?
Yes, but I think his lawyers were challenging what had happened at a later date.
So you were asked about this just to prompt your memory to in your interview at, from page 40 again, and you explain that you're asked by Officer Panuto in that conversation, can you tell us how that conversation came about, Zach telling you? Oh, I withdraw that. I've misled you. So... there is something else that you say of relevance at page 40 onto 41 about this incident. It's in relation to a discussion about body-worn videos. You explain what Zach's attitude was to that from your perspective. You say there was legislation that got brought in when I was there. He, Zach, never had his camera on, never. He never put it on. And he got told off by the lady upstairs, I can't think of her name, the senior sergeant, I can't think of her name. He got emailed by her maybe once or twice about the fact that he hadn't been putting on his body worn, and he still continued not putting his body worn on. Ms. Campagnaro, can you recall who that senior sergeant was now?
Oh, now that I'm here, I'm having a mental blank. She's retired now.
Does Vickery ring a bell?
That's her.
And what did Zach say to you about advice he'd been given about his body worn?
He told me that he'd been asked to put it on by Sergeant Vickery and that he just didn't want to.
Did he say why he didn't want to?
He didn't want people to see what he was doing.
You were asked by Officer Panuto, did he talk to you about that particular, about the body worn not being put on? And you say, so he didn't put it on, because I think sometimes he didn't want that footage of what he was doing to go through the station. That was his justification for that. He'd never put it on though, never. There are, I imagine, some jobs where Constable Rolls' video was on. You make a strong statement there saying he'd never put it on though, never. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I can't say that he never indefinitely had it on, but majority of the time he did not have his body worn video on.
And you go on to say, for example, the Malcolm Ryder case, I don't think he had his body worn on. This is page 41. I recall him saying that thankfully it wasn't on, so they couldn't see what he had done. Is that something that Zach said to you about the Mr. Ryder case?
That is correct.
Did Zach tell you what he had actually done, that he wanted not to be on camera?
He punched him in the head while he was on the ground.
And you explained this when you were interviewed in 2020. You say that they would see, if he'd had his body worn on, that he'd punched him unnecessarily when he was, I think this guy was already in handcuffs as well, and he was being punched. So a huge unnecessary use of force. And you go on, you're asked, is that what Zach told you? And you say, yeah, he and Zendeli both did that. So I don't know whose camera. I think there was a big issue about, there was one person's camera on, I think it was Brett, because Brett is a straight shooter and always, that's how he became a detective so quickly, because he just wanted so badly to be a great cop. And I think none of them had their cameras on besides Brett. So a lot of the footage, you couldn't see what had actually happened in the incident. The start of that answer, you say, him and Zendeli both did that. in relation to punching Mr. Ryder. How do you know that Zendeli also did that?
That told me.
Did you ever have a conversation with her about it?
No, I did not.
Did you ever have a conversation with Brett, Constable Geranius, about it, or Constable Lorraine?
Not that I can recall, no.
They were both more senior in rank to you, obviously.
Yes, they all were.
Did you ever hear from anybody else about who was the detective that had scratched Zach's face?
No, I did not.
So to this day, do you know who that detective was?
No, all I know was that it was a female.
And how do you know that?
He told me.
When you say he, you mean Zach?
Sorry, Zach told me. It was a female detective from upstairs.
Did you actually ever see a scratch on his face after that incident?
Not that I can recall, no.
Can you have a look, Ms. Campagnaro, at your interview, pages 11 and 12? I appreciate I'm asking you to go back to an interview that you gave a couple of years ago. At the bottom of page 11, you're asked about this incident of someone scratching him.
Okay.
And you say, a member who had worked upstairs that was a detective had scratched him. I do not know who it was. He never said who it was, not to me. And then over the pages, you're asked, okay, can you recall whether or not there was any visible injury that you saw? And he said, I think there was literally a scratch from someone scratching him. You're asked to describe it and you say, oh, I'm trying to think. I actually can't remember. I don't want to guess. I can't recall where it was, but it was a scratch. Just thinking back on it, did you see a scratch or did you just hear the story about him being scratched?
I can't remember seeing a scratch. This was 4 years ago.
Sure. And just to finish up on that topic, you explain part of this at page 13. Where you say, what I know is, like I said, Malcolm Ryder ran out with his phone, so I know I've been told that. Then Brett sprayed him, but Brett was known for spraying people just like off the bat all the time. And then I know that Zach was punching him. He said that's what happened. Him and his ex-girlfriend were punching him. Because then in the interview, Malcolm Ryder kept saying, he hit me. He actually said to me, that man had black in his eyes. He said he hit me. And it was just like the worst, like my first interview I'd ever done. It was ridiculous. Is that a truthful account of what you were told?
That is truthful, yeah.
When you reflect on that now, Ms. Campagnaro, what impact do you think that might have had on a young officer, a probationary constable, in their first month of the job?
I think back now, and I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I should have reported it, but I was going under the guidance of my senior police officer. I just remember thinking at the time that it was ridiculous.
Did you feel any empathy for Mr. Ryder?
A lot of empathy, yeah.
Did you feel like there was anybody, this is before you started going out with Zach, did you feel like there was anybody that you could talk to raise your concerns?
No. I didn't feel like I could speak to anyone about it.
Within a short period of time, like a couple of weeks, Zach was asking you out on dates and you started dating him and then you were engaged a short time later. Someone might question why it was that if you were concerned about what had happened in January, you prepared to start a relationship with him. What do you think about that now?
Well, at the time, I fell for a charming fellow police officer. And when you think you're in love with someone, you know, you're just going to listen to what they say and go with it. So I think back to it now and I think, yeah, I should have done things a lot differently, but that's hindsight for you.
You, I think, moved in with Zach in Alice Springs, is that right?
Yes, I did.
You met his parents, correct?
Yes, I did.
He met some people in your family, is that right?
Yes, he did.
He met your grandma you talk about?
He did.
He met your mum?
Yes, he did.
And did all that happen prior to June 2018?
Yes. Yes, it did.
So I'm reminded by the Proctor report, Your Honour, at page 34, that on the 5th of June 2018, Mr Ryder put in a complaint of improper conduct by police, which involved an allegation of excessive force. And his claim was that it was excessive because of the use of OC spray, the takedown to the ground, the strike to the head, the pulling of the hair, and kneeling on his back. The matter was investigated by Police Standards Command, and it was determined that the use of force was reasonable. Another matter identified, however, was that the body-worn video footage was not activated for Constable Rolfe or three of the others. Do you remember any discussions with Constable Rolfe about that around June 2018?
Yes, I do.
And what did Zach say to you?
He just told me that they were being investigated about what had happened in the Ryder case.
And you explain this in your interview at page 14. You say, when it came up again, so this is like 6 months later, after January, maybe a bit longer after this happened, the defence were trying to build a case against him and his ex and whoever else was involved in that job, trying to say they had used unjustified force against Malcolm. So that's when it got brought up again. And you say, I know his mum was concerned, like trying to get involved, and he, Zach, was really manipulative. So even though he told me that all this stuff had happened, he would try and justify to you out loud that had happened because Malcolm had done something wrong, but he hadn't. Like, he just ran out with his phone. So he just mentioned again that him and Zendeli had punched him. So around this time, about 6 months after you first interviewed Mr. Ryder, you became aware that Mr. Ryder's defence team were saying that there was unjustified force used against him. Is that right?
Yes, I do. And that's correct.
And you know, Ms. Campagnaro, well, I'll draw that. It follows, does it, from what you've told us already and what you told police, that you had reason to believe unjustified force had been used against Malcolm?
Yes, it was.
Did you think at that time, 6 months later, that you should come forward and explain that?
No, I didn't, no.
You were still in a relationship with Zach at that time?
Yes, we were still in a relationship in June.
And do you think now, looking back on it, that even though you're a young officer, it was your obligation to come forward?
Yes, I do. I think about that all the time.
Is there anything that you want to say about that? Because some of Kumanjai's family are in the room and it's important to them to understand the process of the police. And no doubt Mr. Ryder might be interested in it too. Do you want to reflect on it and make a comment?
I feel really sad that I was a part of, you know, a cascade of events that led to that, and I do, even though I was brand new, I should have had more of a voice. and reported it, but I didn't, and I am. I'm really sorry about that.
Ms. Campagnaro, I'll move on from that topic and ask you something about attitudes generally in Alice Springs. You were young, 24, and you're a probationary constable. Do you recall hearing other police in Alice Springs Station use derogatory terms about Aboriginal people?
Yes, I do.
You've heard in this inquest some of the terms that have come out, and I'll just ask you it as an open question. In the police station, what sort of derogatory terms would you hear used to describe Aboriginal people?
Coon, Kunga, Nigger, just terms like that.
Kunga. And when you first heard them, were they terms that that your friends or family would have used at any time before you got to the police force?
Absolutely not. I don't even like saying it now.
Were you shocked when the first times you heard it?
Yes, I was.
Did you hear that on more than one occasion?
Yes, I did.
Did you hear Zach use language like that?
Yes, I did.
Did you hear him use language like that in the police station?
Yes, I did.
Did you hear sergeants use that sort of language?
Yes, I did.
Did it shock you that people of senior rank, like sergeants, were using that language?
It did when I first started. But then when you're there, everyone around you was using those terms.
Do you think you became desensitised to it by the time you left the station at the end of the year?
To a degree, yeah.
At that time, did you have a thought process going on that the use of that language was dehumanising of Aboriginal people?
Incredibly dehumanising, yes.
And is it something that you ever raised with your seniors?
No, I didn't.
Is it fair to say that would have been very difficult to do as a probationary constable when some senior officers were using that language?
Incredibly difficult. When the seniors are doing it, you have no one to turn to.
Did you ever hear a senior officer, senior constable or sergeant or anyone above that rank, pull someone up for the use of racist language?
No, I didn't.
I've asked you about that incident with Mr. Ryder. Were there any other times in Alice Springs Police when you were there for your year where you heard of police officers covering up for each other for the use of excessive force?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Did any of those involve Zach?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Can you remember any other specific incident that involved Zach?
I remember one involving a river, so the Todd River, where he had punched someone in the river with another officer called Barclay. And, yeah, that's the only really specific one that I can think of.
And do you remember roughly what time of year it was in that year of 2018?
I believe it was after we were engaged, so sometime after the end of March.
And how did you find out about that?
He told me. Zach told me.
What did Zach tell you about it?
Well, he told me that's how he'd injured his wrist, was in this, you know, this incident in the river. And he'd punched someone with this fellow officer. That's all I can remember.
Did he tell you why he punched him?
No, he didn't. I think it was during an arrest.
Do you know whether or not the person who was arrested was an Aboriginal person?
Not that I can recall.
Do you recall whether he told you if they were or weren't Aboriginal?
No, I can't remember that.
Did you know this other person, Barclay?
Yes, I did, but he was on a different patrol group to me.
Was the person that was punched arrested, do you recall?
I can't recall, sorry.
Do you remember whether or not that matter ever went to court?
Not that I think, but I don't think so.
Did you ever discuss that matter with any of your superiors?
No, I didn't.
Did Zach ever say anything to you about female cops in general in the force and what he thought of them?
Not that I can remember, no.
What about bush cops? Do you recall any discussion with him about bush cops?
No, he just said they were lazy.
In what context did he say that?
I think we were just talking about bush cops in general. I can't really remember a specific conversation.
You explain in your interview that Zach's plan that you knew about was to get into the TRG.
Yes, it was.
What did he say to you about that?
He had previously tried before we were together, and then he was trying again when we were together. So that was the ultimate goal, was to be in TRG in Darwin.
And he also wanted to get, you explained in your interview, he was interested in to get into the SAS.
Yes, he was.
Did he tell you why he wanted to get into the SAS?
He wanted to be paid to go out and shoot people.
Do you remember when he said that to you? Roughly what time of year?
It would have been after we started dating, so February onwards.
And was anyone else with you when he said that?
No, not that I can recall, no.
Do you recall whether or not he said that to you? I'm not suggesting it's funny, but do you recall whether what you thought when he said to you?
I mean, it wasn't until later on in the relationship that I started thinking those comments were vile.
So at the time he said that, what were you thinking?
I can't recall.
Excuse me for a minute, Ms. Campagnaro. There's a little sign on there saying your mic's been muted, but do you think that's okay then? Thank you. In page 24, when you tell the interviewers about this with the SAS, you say, he didn't like being in the NT police. He thought it was a joke. And, yeah, he just wanted to get into the SAS because basically, yeah, they go away for long periods of time, get paid a lot of money and go out and kill people. They go out on missions. And you're asked, so tell me about this. You've mentioned it two or three times now about that they go out and kill people. Has there ever been, or can you describe any conversation you have had with Zach that might touch on that sort of thing? And you say, yeah, there's a few conversations. It's not necessarily related to that about going and killing people. Zach said on several occasions to me, and probably other people too, that he would like to shoot someone, then you can go on a paid holiday. Because obviously when you shoot someone, you go under investigation, like what is happening now, and you go on a paid holiday. And I actually remember saying that to one of my best friends. This was way after the fact when we broke up. And they actually said, what did you ever see in that guy, etc. So in relation to what Zach said to you, when he said, I'd like to shoot someone so I can go on a paid holiday, what tone did he say that in?
So this was towards the end of our relationship because I actually remember saying to him, no, that's not the kind of holiday that I want to go on. And I remember feeling at that time uncomfortable about him saying that.
And did you towards the end of your relationship start to feel more uncomfortable with some of the things he was saying?
Yes, I did, because I'd started telling my best friend about it.
And in the interview, you're specifically asked by Officer Panutu, I want to clarify, I'm going to have to ask a direct question to clarify this. So are you telling us that Zach Rolfe told you that he wanted to be in a position, he wanted to shoot someone? And you say yes. And Officer Panutu said, are you also telling us that you've had a conversation of that nature on more than one occasion with Zach? And you say yes.
That is correct.
Another thing you say in your interview at page 30, towards the bottom of that page is, so he loved arresting people. He was active, like he was good in that sense, I suppose. But he didn't care about or like any of the Indigenous people there. I know this because he told me that a lot of his unjustified forces were just swept away by the senior sergeants that were in charge of him. So I just want to break down that a little bit. You have said there that Zach didn't care about or like any of the Indigenous people there. You mean there in Alice Springs, is that right?
That's correct.
And what did he say to give you that understanding?
I mean, he definitely told me that working Alice Springs was a joke. And he just, yeah, would use derogatory terms when referring to Indigenous people.
Okay. And when you say there that a lot, he told me that a lot of his unjustified forces were just swept away by the senior sergeants that were in charge of him. You mean that Zach actually specifically told you, Ms. Campagnaro, that the unjustified use of force was swept under the carpet?
Yes, he did. He told me that Lee Bowens and Alistair Gawley had on several occasions dealt with his, you know, reports and unjustified forces for him.
And when he was telling you that, did he say that they had dealt with his use of force or his unjustified use of force? That is, did he give you the impression that the force he used was not justified and they just got rid of it?
Yes, that's correct.
What did you think about that at the time when he was telling you?
I mean, at the time, I just thought they were helping him out.
What do you think about it now that you look back on it?
I mean, I look back at this period now and I feel embarrassed that I went along with any of this. You know, it just, I don't know, I feel deeply embarrassed that I was a part of this cycle of behaviour.
I just want to read to you something that you say at page 27. Chair, I'll go back to page 26. It's the issue in relation to Zach telling you that he wanted, on several occasions, about wanting to shoot someone to go on a paid holiday. And you say, I don't think there was anything in particular. He just said on several occasions, he just said on several occasions, and I know I said, I don't think that it would be a fun holiday at all. I said, because I remember, obviously, when you're a cop, people talk about, like, what happens if that does happen to you. Do you mean there what happens if you actually do shoot someone?
Yes. So I remember, personally, I was frightened at the idea of ever having to use my gun. So for me, that was a scary idea of going on a, you know, a paid holiday. You know, it's not a holiday. You're stood down from work until an investigation is completed.
And Zach had a different view from what you tell us.
Yes, he saw it as a holiday.
And you said to him, it's not a holiday. They freeze all your assets. They work out how much money you actually use, and they only let you utilise the money. That it's a massive process. It's not a good thing. On several occasions I said that, and he just thought it would be a holiday. That was actually his words. It would be a holiday. I want to go on a paid extended holiday. I don't know the circumstances, though, because it had been said numerous times. I'm not suggesting that it's a funny thing to say, but did you at the beginning think he was joking, or did you take him seriously?
I mean, I thought he was joking because it's not funny and it's not a holiday to the average person. So, but I remember he kept saying it and I started thinking, you know, it's not a normal comment to say. You know, I was scared of that kind of thing.
And you go on to say, I thought it was horrible and I still do. I never thought that it was a good idea, never. And that's when I started to realise that the person I thought I'd fallen in love with, it was not actually him at all. He put on this massive pretense in the beginning to kind of, because I would see myself as being a nice person that gives a shit about people, and that's why I became a nurse, because I really want to care for people in that way. Towards the end of the relationship, I realised that he was just totally different to how I thought he was. He was really different. And you give some examples in the interview to things that he said and things that he did that made you concerned about him. And I'm not going to read them all out onto the record. But do you think that the scales fell off your eyes a little bit while you were going out with him?
Sorry, I didn't hear that last bit.
Do you think that the scale, your attitude, well, I'll put it neutrally, did your view of him change from the time you started going out with him to the end of it?
Oh, definitely. When we first met, I thought he was very charming, but I thought he was so kind and generous, and by the end of it, he was just the total opposite of what I thought he was. The charm had well and truly fallen.
In terms of, I'm going back to the issues in relation to people turning a blind eye to the use of force. When you were out of the relationship at the end of 2018, did you think about raising any of those issues with him?
No, I didn't.
And did you think about raising them with your superiors?
No, I didn't.
If what would you say if someone at the bar table says to you, well, what you're saying now is just because you had a breakup with Zach, you didn't like him by the end, like sometimes happens in romantic relationships, and so you're saying this just to get back at him. What would you say to any suggestion like that?
Absolutely not. This entire process has caused me nothing but grief and stress. I would never go out of my way to say something negative about someone. I've purely been doing this to assist the NT police and now the coronial process.
I've only got a couple more topics for you, Ms. Campanaro. In terms of Zach's attitude to management, you've told us already that he had some problems with the body-worn video footage, and you told us that he was reluctant to turn his body-worn on. You note in your interview at page 35 a particular attitude he had to Officer Vickery.
Yeah.
You said, Claudia, you're asked by Officer Panuto, Claudia, you said to us just a minute ago that he didn't have much time for the way NT police were doing it. Can you describe any conversation you had where he described how he thought things should run? And you say no particular conversations. I just thought he thought management could have been better. He didn't like the clientele we were dealing with. He didn't like the managers. He didn't like the people we worked with. He felt that all the females that he had come through weren't deserving of their spots. In relation to the females not deserving of their spot, was that in relation to TRG or what spots?
I think just getting into the police in general. because they were having a massive recruitment drive to get females in. So actually a lot of the male officers believed that, you know, the women who were getting through weren't worthy of their positions.
And was that something that you heard discussed within the station in Alice Springs?
Not directly, but I just felt like every day I was having to prove myself to some senior male officer that thought I didn't deserve to be there.
How did that impact on you in terms of your job?
It was incredibly stressful. I just felt like every small mistake I made or everything I was doing was being heavily scrutinized.
You talked about an instance or some issues in terms of Zach's use of force and what your thoughts at the beginning for the sergeants who were turning a blind eye to them. You thought at that time that they were just trying to help him out. Did you feel like anybody would help you out in those circumstances?
No, I don't, but I, you know, wasn't using unjustified force when I was arresting people. So I didn't need that.
Sure. Did you feel at the time like those senior sergeants were trying to have Zach's back? They were trying to help him?
Yes, they were.
Did you feel like, I'm asking about the culture at Alice Springs Police Force, did you feel like the male senior officers had your back?
No, I don't.
Did that have any impact on your ability to stay in the Northern Territory Police?
Well, I mean, I just felt, I mean, the job wasn't for me, but I realised that. But no, it didn't impact me staying there. I'd made up my mind I wanted to leave and I left.
Zach was on patrol group 5 in that last year, in 2019. Was he, I'm not entirely sure, 2018 off the top of my head. Can you recall?
He was on my patrol group with me by the middle of the year, I believe, in 2018. So, yeah, patrol group 5.
And then did you stay on his patrol group after you started dating?
Yes, I did.
Just going back to the issue of managers, you say, paragraph 35, he hated, what's-her-name, she had all those things on her shoulder. I've already forgotten the terminology. It was one of the female people in charge, like upstairs. She wore glasses. He hated her. He didn't like her at all because he claimed that she changed what happened on the job when he saved those people from the river. But I can't remember her name. She's got dark hair, wears glasses, and had a lot of shiny brass on her shoulders. Was that Officer Vickery?
Yes, it was.
And can you tell Her Honour what Zach said to you about the river rescue and what management had done there?
He believed that Vickery had changed the details of the job because she had originally advised him not to go to the river because he was a probationary constable. So he believed that her changing, you know, the narrative of it led to him not getting the highest medal, you know, that he wanted.
And did he tell you that fairly soon after you started dating?
Yes, because he was being awarded a bravery medal in Canberra.
And did you go with him to that ceremony?
Yes, I did.
And did
I went to the one in Canberra.
And did his attitude to Officer Vickery change at all while you were there?
No, I don't think he ever liked her.
At page 18 of your interview, you are talking about Constable Rolfe being pretty sporty and keeping fit. Can I first ask you, do you recall him getting into the IRT or being in the IRT?
Yes, I remember him being in the IRT.
What did he say to you about the IRT, if anything?
He thought it was fun. Well, I can't remember specifics about what he said.
In relation to him being active, at page 18 you say that there were times when you were in a relationship, well, you asked whether or not you saw him taking medications, and you say he injected peptides to recover, get his injury recovered. Do you know where he got the peptides from?
Did he say where or when?
Where?
Online, I believe.
And that was my question. Do you recall him going to a GP and getting a prescription for those, or was it something he got online?
Yeah, it was online, not prescribed.
Do you know what they were?
Just that they were peptides.
And do you recall what stage of your relationship he was using them?
Maybe midway through.
Do you recall how long he used that for?
No, I don't recall how long.
And they were injectable peptides, is that right?
Yes, they were.
And do you recall, was there any other... Did you see him inject those peptides, or were you told about it?
I was just told about it.
And do you recall him telling you anything about taking any other drugs?
No, I don't recall that.
Did you know him to be someone who smoked marijuana, for example, from time to time, or had hash cookies or anything like that?
No, not when he was with me, no.
And similarly, MDMA or ecstasy, is that something that you ever knew him to do?
No, not at all.
The peptides that you talk about were for injury recovery, is what you explain in your interview. Zach went to the gym a lot. Did you know him to ever use any performance-enhancing drugs like testosterone?
No, not when he was with me, no.
In terms of the time that you were with Zach from over the course of 2018, did you have any concerns about his mental health?
I thought he had a bit of PTSD.
Why did you think that?
He's had nightmares a lot. But other than that, no.
You explain in your statement about a bad dream where you woke up one night and he had his hands around your neck and that he told you that he'd been having a nightmare.
Yes, that's correct.
And you accepted that that was a genuine explanation from him at that time?
Yes, I did.
And did you ever talk to him about... why he might have done that or why he might be having those nightmares?
I told him I thought he had PTSD, but he said that PTSD wasn't real.
Did you ever ask him anything about what had happened while he was on deployment in Afghanistan?
I can't recall.
I'll withdraw that. Do you understand, given your background in nursing and your time in the police, that one symptom of PTSD or even depression might be poor sleeping?
Well, Jake, that happens with...
I'll withdraw that. That's actually just trying to help your client, but that's fine. Did you know whether or not Constable Rolf ever raised any concerns with management about it?
No, not that I remember.
We heard some evidence yesterday from Officer Mitch Hansen. Did you hear any of that evidence on the live stream?
I heard a bit of it.
And Officer Hansen explained about the impact of going to so many very stressful jobs, seeing a number of jobs that involved violence and how to cope with that and doing some reading himself on how to cope with it. Do you recall any discussions during your training with the police about how you deal with very confrontational situations, the impact on you?
We were advised not to drink, not to eat poorly, and to discuss it with our peers.
Do you recall being advised about the services that you could go to if you weren't coping? For example, if you were having nightmares?
Not that I can recall, but I'm very sure that we would have been told that in the academy.
You say something about this in your interview at page 64. So on the back of a question that Officer Panuto asked you, say, so you mentioned Indigenous Have you ever, or can you describe any conversations that you might have had with people that led you to believe that there might have been an issue related to Indigenous people? And you say, and he goes on to say, all the relationships between police and Indigenous people. And you say, not specific conversations, but it was well known that the majority of our jobs were domestic violence between Indigenous people, PCAs. So picking them up off the streets for Indigenous people, like rarely do you go to a white person job, and that's just like a fact. The relationship wasn't good. They didn't trust police, or I would say police officers. You're referring there to Indigenous people?
Yes, I was.
And you say, I guess everyone gets complacent and gets over what they do day in, day out. And they just, I guess, stop seeing them as like humans. And it became more of just like, pick them up off the street, take them to the watch house. There wasn't a good relationship. They hated the police, like hated. So that's my view. That's an interesting reflection that Her Honour will want to know about, Ms. Campagnaro. From your own perspective, do you feel like you picked up a lot of Aboriginal people and put them into protective custody? Or is that what you're watching other people do?
No, that's what I had specifically done myself.
Did you think that's what the job was going to involve when you went into the Northern Territory Police?
No, I didn't think that majority of the jobs were going to be picking up Indigenous people off, literally off the ground.
And did it affect you, do you think, in a way, negatively during the year there?
I struggled seeing the suicide jobs. I remember I had a bit of a hard time post that. But yeah, it did form part of the reason why I left. It just wasn't what I wanted to do with my life.
Do you feel like you became desensitized to people, to seeing Aboriginal people suffering?
I'm sure that I did by the end of it, yeah.
And was there anything that in your training that helped you to understand that at the time?
Not really, no.
Final question, I think, and so I'll ask that we take a break after this, Your Honour, and you'll just reflect. At page 73 of your interview, you talk about hearing that Zach had been the one who was involved in Kumanjay's death, and you say halfway down the page, I wasn't surprised if that's what you got asked. Like, I wasn't really surprised that it was him. If it was going to be anyone that was involved in that kind of thing, it was going to be him. Why was that? Why did you think that?
Because of previous comments he'd made, you know, about the paid holiday and just his attitudes towards the job.
Thank you, Honor. Is that a convenient time to have a break? Yes. Ms. Campagnaro, we just have a 15-minute break.
Well, I'm making
20. Let's just cut 20 minutes. Sure. Thank you. We'll have a 20-minute break. It's sometimes a little bit longer than that, but we'll aim for 20 minutes, and we'll get you back on the link shortly.
Okay.
Thank you.
All set? All set?
Craig, I'll put that down to you. Please be seated. Your Honour, I've asked tonight, if you wouldn't mind hearing from me before we receive this witness.
Yes.
I hand Your Honour an email that's been sent to my client, Zachary Rolls, and I want to read it into the transcript because it is significant in the context of the question by Council Assistant, and we can give approval to bring this into the transcript. Shortly before the break, Detective Superintendent Lauren Bill, professional standards command, emailed my contact with Bob Rolfe in these terms. Hello, Constable Rolfe. Please read the email below for context, and this email is to provide formal advice to you. Please note that subject officers have received individual emails specific to their circumstances, which include the email below, and caveats similarly apply. Following the public comments by Judge Borchers in the Alice Springs Local Court, a particular number was created. Due to the gravity of an allegation, an alleged serious criminal offence, the investigation was conducted by Crime Division and was recently reviewed by Crown Command, it is determined that there is no evidence to support the allegation of perjury associated to the comments made by Jack Borchers following the hearing of Mountain Rider. I have also reviewed the internal investigation, and there is no evidence to support a breach of discipline, and the allegation is not substantiated. Legal counsel, the Commissioner of Police, have also provided the same advice to the coroner in the early days of the inquest into the death of Kumi Noah Walker. The email goes on and reads as follows. Hello, this email is to provide you with advice on a complaint against police that was reopened and further examined due to a police shooting at Uinaloo in 2019. I have been told you may be aware of this matter being re-examined. My apologies. This is addressed to the officers who are addressed to Brianna Bonning, Cameron Chatterton, Brett Uranius. In June 2018, a complaint against police by Malcolm Ryder was received by the Office of the Ombudsman. This incident involved officers Rolfe, Bonning, Chatterton, Uranius, Lee Rain, Zendelli's attendance, and as an address in Alice Springs identified. Sergeant Roche of the then Complaints Management Division sought and received a response from each of you which was consistent with your initial statements. The Section 92 report refers to the Ombudsman's Act signed in October 2018 and the relevant parties notified of the outcome. The CAP was closed and findings determined the police action was lawful and reasonable in relation to the use of force, and remedial advice was provided by Acting Senior Sergeant Roche by email and Acting Superintendent Furness by email about use of body-worn video. The hearing from Mr. Ryder, the defendant, was held in the Alice Springs Local Court on 3 September 2018, 2 to 3 April 2019, and on 9 May 2019. The charges against Mr. Ryder were dismissed. Judge Borchers, when handing down his decision, criticised the conduct of some attorney members and considered the evidence given by both Constable Rolfe and Constable Zendelli to be untruthful. These comments were reported to the media. The publicly stated comments by Judge Borchers were referred to the Professional Standards Command. I wish to confirm that the complaint against police is closed. In other words, Your Honour, from a police perspective at least, that is a complete end of the matter. And Your Honour would, of course, understand that this current witness will be part of that comprehensive investigation. I tend to be Your Honour.
Yes, happy to have that marked as an exhibit. Yes, Your Honour, and I just note for my learned friend's benefit, the documents are tendered through counsel assisting an inquest, so I'll tender that, Your Honour, next. Thank you. Well, we'll receive that, and that can be marked as an exhibit. Thank you, Your Honour. And if the witness could come on the list.
Hello.
Hi. We're just getting the video up, but I can hear you at the moment, Ms. Campagnaro.
Okay.
Okay, so I think you need to join Teams.
Rejoin.
Yeah. Thank you. We've got to, sorry, did you have anything?
No, I didn't, Your Honour. So I was just jumping up to let Ms. Campagnaro know I don't have any further questions. I apologise, Mum.
So Mr. Mullins will ask some questions. You can see, I think, Ms. Campagnaro, that there are a number of different lawyers around the table, so there's a few different people who probably would like to ask you some questions, and they'll let you know who they are and who they represent.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Honour. Good morning, Ms. Campagnaro. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
My name is Mullins. I appear on behalf of the Brown family. I just want to ask some questions about your relationship with Constable Rolfe. As I understand it, you arrived in Alice Springs just prior to 2018, is that right?
That's correct.
And did you meet in November 2018?
November or December?
2018 or 2017?
Sorry, 2017, okay.
And you were not in a relationship at the time?
No, we weren't.
You were, but you personally weren't in any relationship with another person?
No, I was not.
And you were sort of the new kid in town, is that right?
Very new.
And you were open to a new relationship?
Yes. Yes, I was.
You were a little overwhelmed, as I understand your statement, by the wave of attention you initially received from Constable Rolfe?
Yes, that's correct.
He was very kind to you in that
yes.
initially, and he was very kind to your dog, Bear.
Yes.
I understand that he took him walking when he was crying or something?
Yes, he was while I was working.
Yeah, and so he was very attentive to you?
He was, yes.
And was very nice to you in other people's presence.
Yes.
And from your observations at the station, he was nice and friendly to other people as well?
At times, yes.
And even his mother, for example, at one point in time made comments about how nice and how happy he seemed to be.
Yes.
You say in your statement at one point, his mum made comments to me saying, we've never seen him like this before, like when he was being really nice to me and like in love and stuff. They said, we've never seen him like this before, like never, ever, ever before. His mother said that to you?
Yes, she did.
And you must have felt good, first of all, that she said that.
Yes.
And you must have felt very good that he felt that way about you.
Yes, I did.
Now, just on the day before your birthday in 2018, Constable Rolfe proposed.
Yes, he did.
And you accepted his offer?
I did.
Had you been engaged before?
No, I hadn't.
There was a lot of fanfare around the engagement. I understand you went to a winery, is that right?
No, it was a restaurant.
And you had a photo shoot?
Oh, an engagement shoot, yes, after the engagement.
And where was that? At what winery?
That was in Adelaide, but it was at various locations.
And you had some plans for the wedding?
Yes, to be married.
And you had arrangements? I understand that you picked out a wedding dress?
I started to, yes.
Organised some bridesmaids?
Yes.
Your bridesmaids, at one point in time, you bought some boxes for them?
Yes, I did.
And one was Regan, was it?
Yes.
And your bridesmaids were very excited?
Yes, they were.
And your family was very excited?
Yes, they were.
And on reflection, you committed to the relationship in it very heavily, very early?
Yes.
But over that period of time, you began to see some aspects of Constable Rolfe's behaviour that concerned you.
Yes.
One of those was the rider situation that you've described to Council assisting.
Yes.
Another was the way he spoke about Indigenous people. You didn't like that?
That's correct.
The way he spoke about the body-worn videos and that the fact that he wasn't wearing his body-worn video from time to time?
Yeah.
Did you not like the way he behaved around some of his friends?
No, I didn't.
You mentioned the PTSD or the event that you attributed to PTSD, which is the event where you woke up with him with his hands around your throat. Can you just describe your recollection of that?
Well, I woke up and his hands were around my throat, but he was having a nightmare.
And did he say it was from PTSD, or is that something you deduced?
It's something I deduced.
Was he taking any medication for anything that you know?
No, I don't know.
But can I suggest that you were a very forgiving and understanding person?
I am, yeah.
You're one of those people who realise that not everybody's perfect?
Yes.
And you're prepared to forgive some of these things that you saw as being potentially problematic in his behaviour?
Well, I was in love and in a relationship.
And you felt that the positives in the relationship outweighed the negatives?
At the time, yeah.
As time moved on, though, you realised as you were getting potentially toward a wedding that you're going to be in a long-term relationship with this person.
Yes.
And can I say you're a traditional type person who respects long-term relationships?
Yes.
And thinks they're important?
Yes.
And who thinks trust is important in a long-term relationship?
Yes.
As his behaviour started to change, some of the kindness started to evaporate, is that right?
That's correct.
You started to doubt his honesty, both personally and professionally?
Yes.
You started having doubts about whether he was likely to be a suitable long-term partner because you couldn't trust him?
We started to have issues, yes.
Did you think that you're having difficulty trusting him?
Yes, towards the end.
And ultimately the relationship ended, and irrespective of whether he broke it off or you broke it off, it's likely that it would have ended anyway, because you wouldn't have entered a long-term relationship with a person you couldn't trust.
I mean, I can't make assumptions on what would have happened.
All right. Now, you told the council assisting that you've moved on the best you can?
Yes, I have.
You're giving this evidence because you have to give it?
Yes, I am.
You don't have any particular hard feelings toward Constable Roll. Is that right?
Absolutely not.
If anything, you feel a bit sorry for him, that he's had to go through this court proceedings and whatnot.
Well, yes.
Things worked out for you a lot better in the end.
I mean, I can't comment on his life. I don't know what he's up to, but my own life is going well, yes.
And you're simply telling the truth to the court about what he told you and what you observed.
Yes, I am.
Nothing further. Thank you, Anna.
Any other questions? Thank you. Ms. Campagnaro, my name's Beth Wild and I'm the lawyer for Naja.
Hi.
I'm going to jump around a little bit so we don't have to go back over evidence you've already given. You had said in evidence, Ms. Campagnaro, that you didn't like what Mr. Rolf said about Aboriginal people. Is that right?
Yeah, right.
And I just want to go to you as read out a specific example, which is at page 33 of the statement. This is a conversation that happened in front of your friend Chelsea. You were there, and you said that Zach said he told her, I was there, that the Indigenous people's heads are like rocks, like you can't break through them. Do you remember him saying that to your friend Chelsea?
Yes, I do.
You're asked by the officer what you thought about that, and you said, I think he just devalued their lives and just think and just didn't think that they were worth much, to be honest. He just thought that it was another arrest and just didn't care, really. Is that what you thought at the time?
That's correct.
Is that what you still think?
Well, I can't really make comments on what he's like now. I don't know him.
Okay. And that was the response you gave when you were asked about Zach's attitude towards Indigenous people. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I now want to talk about the support that Zach Rolf got after the shooting. You were contacted by a lot of people. Is that right?
Yes, I was.
Even though they knew you'd broken up with him?
Yes.
And why were they contacting you?
Some were reaching out to see if I was okay, and others were just reaching out to tell me that that had happened.
Okay. And you've said that there was a very pro-Zach sentiment, is that right?
When did I say that?
In your statement, when you were talking to police, you said they were very pro-Zach.
Ah, yes, at the time, yes. It was all over the news.
Yes. And so people reaching out to you were very much supportive of Zach Rolfe, is that right?
Yes, they were.
And that's people in the police force?
Yes, it was.
I'll briefly talk about the management structure and at the police station. You said that management was more like a gossip sesh. What did you mean by that?
So there was no privacy in that station. Everything was known to everyone, and it was just like an open field for people to talk about everyone.
Okay. And that that extended to the culture of the police station in Alice Springs, would you say?
Very much so.
When you first started, Zach Rolfe had recently broken up with Jen Zendelli, is that right?
That's correct.
And he made out to you like she was crazy.
Yes, he did.
All right, I'll just go to page 80 of the statement and I'll give you the direct quote that you say to the officers in your interview. You're asked what you know of their relationship before and afterwards, and you said, so I know, so from him, he painted her out to be like they weren't together for very long, that she had sort of moved in too, and he kind of said that, you know, she was crazy. Like when he was at work, she came home to the house and touched his things and went through his stuff, and he just, yeah, painted her out to be like this bit of a stalker in that. So is that your recollection of what he was saying about Jen Zendelli when you first met him?
That's correct.
And would he say that to you as well as other members at the police station?
Yes, that narrative was known by almost everyone in the police station.
Right. And is that what he did to you after you broke up?
I mean, not that I know of directly.
Yes, but you said that he would tell everybody that you wouldn't even walk your own dog. Is that right?
Oh, he did say that to people. Right. He said I wouldn't clean, I didn't walk my own dog after shift.
And we're getting a bit crazy about the wedding planning?
Yeah.
Right, so he was saying that to other people in the station after you broke up?
Yes, he was.
Such that continuing to work there became effectively untenable, is that right?
What do you mean?
You couldn't continue to work there because of all of the things that were being said about you at the station?
That wasn't the only reason why I left.
Okay, was it part of the reason?
It was a small part of it.
Okay, you went to your manager to complain or to a mentor, is that right?
I went to someone in the station that was meant to be like a support contact.
I see. And they dismissed your concerns, is that right?
They told me I would never change the culture of the station.
And you quit the next day?
Yep, I did.
Now, that behaviour of talking about you after you broke up and what he did to Jen Zendelli, would you regard that as gaslighting?
I mean, that's a bit of a pop culture term.
Yep.
You have to tell me the meaning of gaslighting.
All right. Well, his pay is undermining you and making you out to be crazy.
Well, yes, then.
And you said at length in your evidence that you're only here telling this because you've been made to do it?
Yes, very much so.
And you want to help out the coronial process?
Yes, I do.
It's not because you've got any vendetta against Mr. Rolfe?
Absolutely not.
No, and in fact, you're very fair in your statement. You acknowledge that, for example, the saving the tourists was an heroic action.
Well, of course it was. He saved someone from drowning.
Yeah. And you do acknowledge that that after you broke up, you found that everything he did was stupid when you were referring to him wearing his own vest that he bought that wasn't police issue. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right, but you're finding that stuff he does irritating. It's not the same as telling an untruth. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that.
You're very careful in your statement to make sure that what you say is things you've heard with your own ears. Would you agree with
yes.
that too?
Yes, I do agree.
And in fact, you go to some lengths. There's a story about Alex Friedman who Mr. Roth uses that as his Instagram name. Is that right?
He did back then, yeah.
Right. And you're very careful to say that you never heard the explanation for that, but that was explained to your Nana June.
That's true.
So you're very careful to say you never heard him say that to you directly.
No.
But where he has said things to you directly, you've been clear about that also, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
You were living together with Mr. Roth?
Yes.
You spent a lot of time with just him and you. Is that correct?
A lot of time. That's right. Correct.
In fact, you do say at some point that he didn't have many friends outside the police force.
That's true.
Right. So there was a lot of time with just you and him with no one else around.
That's true.
And in those, it was in that context that he was telling you about the paid holiday if he shot someone. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And he would say it many times to you?
Sorry, what was that?
He said it many times to you.
Yes, he did.
The last thing I want to ask you about, and perhaps you can queue it up, that's the exhibit 03077. And page 45 of the transcript. Perhaps we'll just watch it. We've got it up here. Can you see that, Ms. Campagnaro?
I can.
Okay, great. We'll just play this footage. Page 45, when you're asked if you actually saw him effect an arrest. And when you say this, so I'm trying to think if I saw him. Oh, actually, no, I saw once. Everyone was looking for this. I think it was a kid. Like, it's always Indigenous children. And I'll go back to that. But I think it was a young Indigenous man, and we had to get, like, the satellite involved, and he'd been found in one of the abandoned schools, and Zach pulled him out of the bin, like he was in a bin, and he literally pulled him out. That's all I ever saw him do. Are you referring to this incident?
I think it was that incident, yeah.
Right. Now, were you there?
I don't think I was there, no. I saw it on the video.
How did it come to be that you saw it on the video?
Body-worn videos, you can see them. on the application once they've been uploaded? Or if someone shows you, you see them.
Okay, so did Zach show you this video?
I can't recall that. I couldn't tell you.
Was it common for people's videos to be shown to each other?
I'd say yes.
All right, but you can't remember the context of why you saw this. Is that right?
No. No, I can't.
But you specifically remember this incident. Why is that?
I can't tell you why now. This was 4 years ago.
Okay. You're aware that it was subject, the subject of a complaint?
No, I'm not.
Okay. All right, then I'll go back to what you said in this. You said, I think it was a kid, like it's always Indigenous children. What did you mean by that?
A lot of the jobs involve Indigenous children.
Right. And what about Zach's arrests of Indigenous children?
I would just say a lot of them were children because that's just how it was.
Thank you, Ms. Cavanero. No more questions for me.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. McCann.
Thank you. No, Ms. Campagnaro, my name is McMahon and I am for the Karampuru Committee of Yundamu, which is a justice committee. And so that's, if you like, various representatives of the community at Yundamu.
Okay.
The questions I'm going to ask you aren't so much about many of the details that you've been asked so far, but if you like, more thematic issues. So we're looking at issues. You might summarise them as saying some big issues around the inquest rather than a lot of the details. Do you understand?
I understand.
Okay, so the first issue I want to talk to you about is the culture of your workplace. Now, I don't want to go back over the details of the whole Malcolm Ryder matter. You've given evidence about that already. But as I understand it, to summarise, at the point in time when you were conducting an interview with him, in an interview room, is it right to say that he'd been to hospital, that he had stitches in his head, and that you very quickly realised in the interview room, if not before, that his English was very poor? Is that all correct?
That's correct. Yes, it is.
And just so I don't make mistakes, were the stitches in various places in his head?
I just remember one where his eyebrow is. Okay.
And you've already given evidence that you felt uncomfortable about that interview. It didn't seem right to you that it would present. Is that correct? Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say.
So the issue I want to focus your mind on now is you can take it from me that there are many places in Australia where a person who had stitches like that and whose English was very poor, such a person would not be placed in an interview room with two police officers and interviewed about a recent crime, particularly if it wasn't a crime of enormous seriousness. So just take that from me as pretty standard around the country. At that moment in time when you were doing the interview, in the first minute or so when presumably you felt very uncomfortable, wasn't there a situation or a scenario or a way that you could walk out of there or put the interview on pause and say, let's go and talk to our bosses. This just can't be right. This kind of interview can't proceed.
I believe so, yeah.
Did that happen at that time?
I don't think so, no.
So in terms of workplace culture, which is where we started with this, you didn't feel at that time that you and the colleague you were with could go and speak to someone senior and say, this just can't happen?
No, I didn't.
Was there any supervisor around about when you were doing that interview, commencing that interview, saying, look, just get on with it? Sure, there are some difficulties, but just get on with it. Was there anything like that happening?
I don't remember a supervisor being around, but there are supervisors in close proximity. I just went with what my partner was doing.
All right. Now, in your long statement, which you had been taken to several times today already, at various points, and I'm just piecing together a few different answers that you've given, you do speak about the workplace culture, and effectively you say that the culture was terrible, that you say there was bullying. Another point in your interview you say it was awful, and another point you say it was terrible, and so on. Okay, so their answers spread through parts of your interview. You follow?
Yeah.
You also said that one reason it was terrible, as I understand, is that no one manages anyone.
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that a bit? Because in this hearing, we've heard some evidence about the hierarchical nature of the police force, where somebody answers to somebody. Everybody's got to answer to somebody up the chain of command. And it's,
yeah,
it's been compared by at least one witness, maybe more, to a bit of a military structure, that the police operate in a similar way to the military, with that ladder of authority going from the bottom to the top or the top to the bottom. So we've heard about that, and yet your evidence is saying your perception, you were there for about a year, as I understand your evidence, roughly from about October 17 to October, November 18, roughly.
Yeah.
So can you just expand on that idea that no one was managing anyone? How did that manifest itself? How do you understand that? How do you remember it?
So obviously there is a structure you're supposed to follow. So when you have an issue, you go to the next person ahead of you and so forth. But what I meant by no one was managing anyone was someone would do a file, for instance, and just say the file wasn't done correctly, instead of the sergeant telling the probie or the constable how to do it, they would talk about them behind their back with other officers.
So an absence of appropriate mentorship, an absence of appropriate guidance, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And is that something you spoke about with any of your junior colleagues? Is that a thought that you kept to yourself, or is that something that was discussed amongst people roughly at your level at the police station?
I more than likely discussed that with others, but I could not tell you actual conversations.
You talk also in your statement about how the culture worked in terms of the police and what you perceived, what you saw the others doing, and I'll just read you a couple of sentences. I felt like they're all just there for the money, it's just a job, same shit every day, dealing with the Indigenous. So that's one thing you said, and then a bit later in your statement, you're asked about how the police at the station, whether there was an issue relating to Indigenous people, and you gave an answer which the council assisting, Dr. Peggy, read out to you, or she read part of it to you, I think. The jobs were involving domestic violence. You often had to pick up people off the streets, especially Indigenous people, and so on. And then you make a very interesting comment. You say, everyone gets complacent and just gets over what they do day in and day out, and they just, I guess, stop seeing them as like humans. So I just want to ask you about that observation that you made, because it does seem like an important insight. Do you want to develop that a bit? The idea that people got complacent because the work was of a certain kind, and gradually they lost their sense of respect for the people that they were serving. Is that what you, is that the idea you were saying there?
Yes, it was.
And this idea of not seeing people as being like humans, is that something that you relate both to the language that you heard and also the culture that you were part of.
It was definitely a part of the culture. But, you know, I can't recall actual conversations regarding that. It was just the feel of the station.
So it's very complicated thing to describe culture. It's not a problem that you alone would have, Ms. Campagnaro. It's a very complicated concept to come to grips with. So let's just zero in on language, because language is part of culture, and language is a way of understanding culture and gives insight to culture. So can I just ask you some more questions about language? You've said that at the station, you were asked a question by Ms. Dwyer around the concept of things being dehumanising, and then you were asked a question about derogatory terms. You follow it? I'm just checking.
Yeah.
I can see there's someone there with you. Is that bothering you, or is that just someone in the house passing around?
It's just my partner saying goodbye.
Okay. So this idea of words being dehumanising, can I just ask you some questions about that?
Yeah.
You were asked whether other people in the police station used derogatory terms, and your answer was very clear. You basically said you were shocked when you started to hear these terms and that everyone around the place was using these terms. So can we just talk about that in terms of culture? There are many workplaces that I'm sure you know, and I'm sure where you work now in a hospital, or you were trained in a hospital, presumably. Are you working in a hospital?
I am.
I'm sure you don't hear consistent racist language. You're working in a hospital with a multicultural workforce and multicultural community, do you?
Absolutely not.
So let's just contrast that. I mean, everyone in the room knows what hospitals are like, and it's a very easy concept to understand what it's like to work there. Let's just contrast that with being at the police station. Just as we would all expect nurses and doctors and everyone in the hospital to speak respectfully to the patients and about the patients and with the patients, just contrast that to the kind of language that you're hearing around the station so we get a good sense of it.
You wouldn't hear that language in the hospital. You wouldn't. And we deal with Indigenous people day in, day out, post-surgery, and I have never heard that language spoken before.
And how is that different? What was happening at the police station, which is so different?
It was just so freely spoken about, you know, that language about Indigenous people.
Okay. And this is the kind of language that you said to Dr. Dwyer, words like coon and nigger and those kinds of words.
That's correct.
And you know from the rest of your life, outside that 1 year working in the police station there, you know from the rest of your life, the community doesn't generally talk like that at the workplace. You understand that, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So would you say that it's an extremely strong contrast from the rest of the community, such as your hospital and so on, compared to what was happening at the police station?
Yes, it is.
You were also asked to reflect on the idea of reporting up the line. Like, for instance, in a well-run military unit, we've heard some evidence about that kind of unit. If something is going wrong, a concerned member can report up the line to their superior officer and say, there's a problem, I need it fixed. But it sounded from the evidence you gave earlier that that wasn't going to work for you at the police station. Can you just explain why?
Well, nothing was confidential. So if you were making a complaint about someone, that person was going to find out, or the rest of the station was. So I just didn't feel comfortable telling anyone anything.
And was it also the case that your superior officers, like sergeants, were also using this language freely in the way that you've described a moment ago?
Yes, that's true.
And as I understand it, unlike what you'd expect in a well-functioning workplace, it seemed that you were saying that, well, if someone used this language, no one pulled them up for it. No one got them into trouble. Is that your observation?
No. Yes.
All right. And overall, upon reflection, your assessment of that reality is that it was incredibly dehumanizing of Aboriginal people.
Definitely.
And in a way, that's very obvious. I'm sure you understand that and everyone understands that once you hear what you have to say. But would you agree also that when that language is freely used by people of all ranks within a workplace, that it also has a very dehumanizing effect on the people using the words?
I think it makes it seem normal to people when their superiors are using those words, those terms.
And you'd agree that when people are using those words as if it's normal, that that has an impact on the whole culture of the workplace? That seems obvious, doesn't it?
Definitely, yes.
And then that has an impact on the culture of how the police in that workplace interact with members of the community?
Yes, that's true.
Including especially members of the Aboriginal community.
Yes.
So just to summarise all that, in terms of culture, once you start using these words freely, your observation from being there and being shocked and observing is that these words and this kind of language influences or is part of the culture of the workplace, firstly, you agree with that?
Yeah.
And secondly, that influences and is part of the culture of how the police involved deal with Aboriginal people when they're out on the street.
Yes.
Right. Now, if just dealing firstly, I want to ask you about a couple of sergeants who were at the workplace when you were there. And it's important that your answers are clear in your mind because we're talking about a significant matter here. But if I give you the name, for instance, Sergeant Lee Bowens is a witness in this case. Is he a sergeant who, in your mind and in your memory, was freely using these kinds of racist terms?
Yes. Yes, he was.
What about Sergeant Paul Kirkby?
Yes. Yes, he was.
You say that? You're certain about that?
I'm definitely certain about that.
And is that because you remember a particular incident as you say that?
He actually was a senior partner of mine for a period of time, so I know him.
Were you in his patrol group? It's just that I'm not
maybe for a small period of time.
I'm just not familiar with the what you mean when you say senior partner.
So when I first started, he was one of the senior members I was with for, you know, maybe a week or two of my shift.
Yeah. There was a Sergeant Kelly, do you know him?
Sorry, who was that?
Sergeant Kelly.
No, I don't know that person.
You might not, sorry. I'm confused there. He apparently arrived after you were there.
Okay.
And just moving away from people who are sergeants, what about people who are closer to you in age and rank? People like Mitch Hansen. Is he someone who remembers speaking in this way?
Yes, he did.
In fact, in your statement, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said that effectively, your memory was that he hated Aboriginal people.
He did at that time, yeah.
Yeah. In all of these people that we're talking about, we're only talking about that time when you were there in the year up to 2018.
Yeah.
And just so you understand what the people in this room, in this courtroom understand, we had a witness yesterday who was saying, I'm deeply ashamed about the things that I used to say and so on. Okay, so
yes, I did hear that.
A lot of ground has been covered about these issues. There was a Constable Sykes. Is he somebody who remembers speaking in this way? Did you know him?
I met him away from the police force. I didn't know him in the police force. So, no, not when I met him, no.
There was a constable, Adam Eville. Do you remember him?
He's actually a lovely person.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. There was Constable Tony Hawkins, or Senior Constable.
Another lovely person.
Okay, and so when you say someone's a lovely person, you're also saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're also saying it's not someone whom you remember as using this racist language freely.
No, they were very respectful towards me as well.
Okay. So to go back to an earlier answer you gave, at one point in your evidence today, you said everyone was using this language freely. And, of course, everyone means everything. But what you're really saying now, and just correct me if I'm wrong, is that the language was used freely in the presence of everybody. Is that a fair thing to say?
That's probably a better thing to say, yeah.
And you have clear memories that some people use this kind of language freely, and you've named a couple, and you have clear memories that some people did not use this kind of language, and you've described them as lovely people.
Yes. Yeah.
And to finish on that point, would it be fair to say that even though we've only talked about a few names, if I went through all of the names of the people that you work with, there'd be quite a good collection of names of people who use this bad language, racist language, freely. Would that be fair to say?
That is, yes, it is.
And that would it be fair to say that that's at least as many people using that kind of language as those who did not use that kind of language? So in other words, are we talking about roughly half the people you work with might use that language freely and the other half might not?
Yes, yes.
Or is it fair to say that most people use that language freely and a few did not? I'm just kidding.
A lot of people use that language. I can't say everyone used that language, but the majority.
All right. And as I said to you at the beginning, Ms. Campagnaro, we're looking at culture here from the point of view of my client and police working out at Yuendamu and so on. And so the culture of the police force, and in particular Alice Springs, is very important to the people whom I represent. You understand that? And one of the other issues, this is my last set of questions for you. You said that a lot of men, this is your impression, but a lot of men at the station seem to think that a lot of the women at the station didn't deserve to be there. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
And you felt that every day you had to prove yourself to some senior male officer as to justify your presence there.
That's true.
So just to contrast that in the way that we did earlier when we spoke about the difference between, say, a hospital where you work now and a police station. Once again, in a hospital, a very significant part of the workforce is no doubt female. And are you able to clarify this insight of yours by contrasting the way women are treated at a hospital compared to the way they were treated at the police station where you're working?
At the hospital, I'm not always trying to prove my existence. My existence was proven by getting a degree and working towards where I am now. So I just do my job and do it well. So versus in the police force, I felt like every day I was trying to prove why I was there.
Did you feel like there was a hostility to women in the workforce when you were at that police station?
Yeah, there was actually.
Thank you. Nothing good.
just before I come to you, you next, Ms. Anderson, just before one of the other lawyers asks some questions, I just wanted to ask you about the free use of racist language. You've talked about it being freely used amongst people or other members of your rank and of a sergeant's rank, as I understand your evidence.
Yes.
And were there sometimes senior sergeants involved when there was a free use of racist language?
Well, yes, they sat in their offices, but the doors were open, so they could hear everything.
And I understand there might have been some different floors at the police station, but from time to time, did you ever see any people of higher rank down on your floor?
Yes, at times they would come downstairs and just see what was happening, general duties.
And was any of the kinds of conversation that you're talking about, which involved racist terms, in banter or conversation or describing an incident, used when there were more senior members of the police force visiting your area?
Not in front of people like superintendents, not those kind of people. I never heard that language in front of them.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards.
You're on the line, you're on his hands. I think I might be right now. If you're on the line, would you just press on, or would you like to have a shorter lunch? And I'd rather do it in 1 minute.
Sure. Well, let's take the lunch break and we'll come back at 10 to 2. Is that okay with you, Mr. Campagnaro? Can you take the lunch break?
What time was that, sorry?
I'm talking our time. So our time is 10 to 1 now, and we're talking about having an hour's lunch break.
Okay.
Okay.
We could
even
do a short lunch, Robin, if that's possible.
Oh, would it be okay if we had a shorter lunch so we could come back?
That's fine. That's fine by me.
1:30, because I think there are a few people who need to make arrangements about travel. So if it suits everybody, we'll come back at 1:30.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
2:30 our time. That's 2:30 maybe at your time. Well, sir, this is the program.